A romance novelist and a smuggler work together to find a rare jewel in Colombia. Listen as we chat about euphemisms and books about sex, moms who are insistent on traveler's checks, and the roadrunner cheating death. Then we find out if romancing the stone stands the test of time.
Time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glut. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time. James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Test of Time podcast. I'm James Brief, and joining me again to romance this podcast, to romance the stone, is my buddy and pal, the director of this podcast, Alan Noah.
Hi, that's me. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Today, we're going to talk about romancing the stone with Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner.
Right.
You often hear it compared to what kind of film franchise?
Well, the only thing I knew about this movie was that it was kind of an Indiana Jones knockoff. And, you know, watching the movie, I get it because it's an adventure movie. The interesting thing, though, that I was reading today is that, in a way, this movie isn't an Indiana Jones knockoff because the original screenplay was written years before Raiders of the Lost Ark came out. To be clear, this movie was greenlit because of the success of Raiders of the Lost Ark. So maybe it's more of a cash-in than a knockoff, you know, where they had the script and then they decided, well, it could be profitable in a world where Raiders of the Lost Ark made a lot of money. But also, it is worth pointing out that Raiders of the Lost Ark was itself a ripoff of like the old-timey serials that George Lucas grew up watching in the 40s, 50s or whatever. So, you know, it's not like it was a completely original idea. So Diane Thomas, the woman who wrote this screenplay, she was probably inspired by the same kind of serials that she watched when she was younger. So, you know, it's all a ripoff, right?
I remember when I was a kid, I must have been like 5 years old or something. There was this movie. I don't know if I ever actually saw this film, but I remember I either saw a preview for it on TV or at a trailer for something. It was a movie called Alan Quartermain and the Lost City of Gold. You know, Alan Quartermain, who I'd later learn, is he's kind of a classic literary character from the 19th century.
Okay.
And this was actually a sequel to another Alan Quartermain adventure that had been adapted in 84 or 85 called King Solomon's Mines, which was somewhat of a hit, I guess, enough to spawn a sequel. But it's funny because Indiana Jones, you could say, is a ripoff of Alan Quartermain. And then, of course, the success of Indiana Jones spawned, oh, we should adapt Alan Quartermain. We should adapt all these other things.
Right.
So, you know, whether it's a ripoff or not, it's just that you can't help but compare.
That sticks out in my mind now because I just saw Dune, the first one, and then Dune Part 2. And the thing that popped into my mind is, oh, this is a Star Wars ripoff. Of course, it's not a Star Wars ripoff because Dune, the movie, came many decades after the first Star Wars movie, but Dune, the novel, predates the Star Wars movie. And it seems very clear that George Lucas stole a lot of ideas for Star Wars from Dune. So it's all very Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? It's your certain point of view. Which came first and which is the ripoff and which isn't, it's really what you were exposed to first.
Yeah, in the end, it's really hard to prove these things. Yes, all art, you know, has to be inspired from someone else. You know, this is the kind of film that later inspires your Tomb Raider films, which is, I guess, inspired more from a video game, which is probably made, what if we could make Indiana Jones into a computer game? So, you know, it all comes back around to itself. And then, you know, your National Treasures and The Mummy with Brendan Fraser. You know, these are all inspired by the same kind of adventures, but you know, I guess they all take their own spins. I would say that I feel like the poster for this film does a real big disservice of what this film's about, because it really makes it seem like it's a kind of treasure hunt through the jungle,
yeah.
And it really isn't.
Yeah.
And also, There is exactly one vine swinging part in this film, and it's Joan, it's Kathleen Turner that does the vine swinging, and then that inspires, Colton's like, well, I guess if she could do it, I could do it, right. But it's totally her that does it, so it's a very misleading poster that I think was inspired to be more of the swashbuckling adventure that you might be surprised that the film is not.
Right, because the poster is them swinging on a vine together, which doesn't happen in the movie.
Right, but also, you know, while of course we can't not say Indiana Jones, Indiana Jones, Indiana Jones, this film arguably is about Joan Wilder, Kathleen yes. Turner's character, and Colton, Michael Douglas's character. You know when he comes in?
Like 25 minutes, something like that?
25 minutes, yeah. It's almost a half hour into an hour and 45 minute film.
Yeah.
I think it's perfectly fine. You know, the character's not needed until then, because it really is about Joan. Michael Douglas is a big star. This is a Michael Douglas production.
Yeah, he produced it, and he is top billed, which is kind of bullshit just based on the fact that she is the protagonist.
Well, unless she was a big star.
I totally get your point. My counterpoint is that it's always bullshit if the protagonist isn't top billed, regardless of who's a bigger star. And I understand that's a business decision and there's marketing and things like that that factor into those decisions, and also contracts and agents fighting over who gets top billed and all of that bullshit. I'm just saying, in my humble opinion, that no one gives a shit about, the person who has the most screen time, the main character, should be the top billed actor. It's very often not the case, and I know that, but whatever. That's neither here nor there. Let's get into Romancing the Stone. Do you want to tell our listeners what this movie's about, James?
Sure. This film, as we said before, is about Joan Wilder, played by Kathleen Turner. She's a successful but shy romance novelist. When her sister is kidnapped in Colombia, she travels there with a treasure map that she received in the mail. That's because the kidnappers, Ira and Ralph, want to use that map to find a priceless emerald called El Corazon. But another man is also looking for the treasure, the dangerous Colonel Zolo. Down in Colombia, Joan meets an exotic bird smuggler named Jack Colton. Jack agrees to help Joan for a fee. Ralph follows Joan and Jack, who decides that instead of simply handing over the map, they should find the emerald themselves. After they find it, they get separated and Zolo demands the stone. Will Jack and Joan live happily ever after, like the characters in one of Joan's romance novels? Let's talk about it and find out, Al.
Well, yes.
Also, considering there's a sequel that we're going to review next week called The Jewel of the Nile, I guess they at least survive.
Right. And I guess that also kind of preempts my usual question of, was this movie a hit? Because I guess it had to have been, because they made a sequel. And actually, I also do remember a few weeks back when we were talking about Splash, you listed the big hits of 1984, and this was on there.
Yeah, it's actually kind of a fascinating story about the box office of this film. The director of this film is the director of one of our favorite films of all time.
Right, Robert Zemeckis.
Robert Zemeckis, of course.
Back to the Future being our beloved childhood classic.
Yes, of course. This was his first major studio film. And while they were making it, it actually tested really horribly. And the studio was pretty confident it was going to be a big flop. And Zemeckis was actually, he was in the middle of developing Cocoon. Do you remember who directed that?
Yeah, Ron Howard.
Ron Howard, exactly. That wound up being one of his early directing films. But because of the success of this film, Zemeckis wound up making Back to the Future. So,
right.
This film, Romancing the Stone, it came out March 30th, 1984. It opened at number 4 with $5.1 million, and it never made it to number 1.
Really?
It actually, like, 5 weeks later made it to number 2, but it was mostly, like, 3rd and 4th, and it wound up making $76 million.
Wow.
So, you know, that's a huge multiplier. That's, a 15 times multiplier. It made the top 10 of 1984. It was a total surprise hit and wound up being the only top 10 hit for Universal that year.
I mean, I get it. I can see that.
Actually, I should say it should be a 20th Century Fox.
So when the movie opens and it's in like this Old West kind of situation, I pretty quickly figured out that this was not real. And by that, I mean, you know, it's a story within a story. It quickly becomes clear that this is what Joan is imagining in one of her romance novels. There is one line that I thought was really, really funny, and I wrote it down, where she says, "That was the end of Grogan, the man who killed my father, raped and murdered my sister, burned my ranch, shot my dog, and stole my Bible." I thought that was a good line. That was funny.
I did like that line. You know, I didn't know what the opening was. I thought it was a movie and someone was going to yell cut and you were going to see that. But it was obvious that this was some kind of fake out. But there's, I guess, several different genres of romance novels. But when I was in high school, I talked about this before, but I worked at a bookstore. I worked at Barnes & Noble back in the day. And there used to be a section of romance novels. And there were, you know, I would say more the mainstream, a novel that would have romance in it, but that was certainly a big part of it. And then there were the silhouette novels. Silhouette was a book series. I think they were all like red or purple colored, and they all had the kind of Fabio cover as a pirate, you know, those kind of things that you could imagine. And you could just open up to any page and you'd read like some kind of sex scene. So there'd be all these like, and his throbbing manhood was placed into her silky, you know, it was all this. Oh, it was, I mean, it was all these euphemisms, but it was hysterical.
I don't believe I've ever read a romance novel. When 50 Shades of Grey was like a big thing, I picked it up because Courtney was reading it and I flipped through it and I was like, holy shit, this is awful. Just in terms of like the writing, I thought it was atrociously bad and I put it down very quickly. But I don't think I've ever read a full romance novel cover to cover. Have you?
No. I mean, there's no need to. I would imagine it seems not my thing. But I remember when 50 Shades of Grey came out. It may be a coincidence, but I remember an explosion of Kindles in the subway. And I remember thinking people got a Kindle because they didn't want to be seen reading this new blockbuster novel.
Right. Because then everyone can see what you're reading.
Exactly.
Right. But when we, you know, when we leave the fake scene, we see Joan in her apartment. She has an award from Walden Books, your competitor, when you worked at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, Walden Books was more like in malls.
Right. And she has a cat and she really loves her cat. And she has post-it notes everywhere, which made me think of my mom. Because growing up, my mom had a million post-its all over the apartment everywhere. And that was just like how she remembered things, obviously way before cell phones and, you know, digital reminders and stuff. But I liked where this movie was going. I thought that this was an interesting thing because I knew that it was going to be an adventure kind of movie. And it starts in a place that's very different from where you would think that kind of movie would start. Just with this lonely writer talking to her publisher, and she really needs to get out more and live because she creates these amazing stories. But she herself, you know, she's sad and lonely.
I like this character from the beginning, I'll say. And, you know, there's this weird 80s thing. Columbia is just the, like, crime capital of the world.
Yeah, well, they didn't film in Columbia. It was deemed too dangerous, so they filmed a lot in Mexico. I was wondering if it was more dangerous in 1984 than it is in 2024. I haven't been to Colombia, but I know people who have. I have friends. My brother and sister-in-law went to Colombia. I saw beautiful pictures on Instagram. And I wonder, is it much safer now? Or is it just kind of more, it was always, you know, fairly safe and it was just kind of perception?
I mean, I get the same impression. I know a lot of people that go down there.
I also know a million people who go to Mexico and have wonderful, amazing, beautiful vacations. And I've heard a couple of stories about people wandering from resorts and getting into some shitty situations. I think it can happen anywhere, and that doesn't mean that the entire country is bad. You mentioned earlier, it's like 25 minutes before she meets Colton. I was expecting Colton to be more of like a rugged action hero because, you know, Joan very much isn't. And then when we first see Colton, he saves Joan because he's firing at this bad guy. He's got a gun and he can shoot, you know, he's got decent aim, which, by the way, most of the other people in this movie do not have decent aim. Like whenever there's a shootout, good guys, bad guys, whoever, it's just a lot of and no one gets hit. Nobody.
Absolutely. No one gets hit. You're right.
Maybe one or two. But yeah, I was like, okay, so Colton, like, he's in the jungles of Colombia doing something mysterious and dangerous. And then when it was revealed that he was a bird smuggler, I was like, oh, that's weird.
Yeah, and they don't even go anywhere with that.
Right.
You know, it could be kind of interesting. You know, bird smuggling, I assume, means you're bringing birds that you're not supposed to bring to America. And
yeah,
it's probably quite profitable. And I guess he could either have something, one of two things. He could either say a good reason why he's doing it, like, oh, there's so many good places they could be safe and blah, blah, blah. They're cutting down the rainforest here, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Or he could be, you know, Han Solo kind of guy. Yeah, he is, like, presumably bringing these to people that will have them in some kind of habitat. So, okay, you could be kind of redeemed from this.
You know, and it's funny that you say Han Solo, because Colton isn't really interested in helping Joan. And then Joan says, oh, well, if you help me, I'll pay you. And then he says, well, how much? And it did feel very Han Solo-esque. She mentions that she will pay him in traveler's checks. And then he says, are they American Express? And I will admit that I thought that was like a mistake, because I thought that all traveler's checks were from American Express. And I looked it up earlier, and that is not the case. Traveler's checks predate American Express, and they were around long before that. But I only know them from, you know, when we were kids, the 80s and 90s. And at that point, American Express pretty much dominated that market, and they were already losing share, and it was kind of a thing of the past. I remember when I drove cross country with my friend Aaron Newman, who's been on the show before, my mom insisted that we get traveler's checks because it was safer. And I remember my reaction being, cool, what the hell's a traveler's check? And I think that was the only time I ever used them in my life.
I went overseas once after college, and my mom insisted I had traveler's checks as well. But I think that that line comes from commercials about traveler's checks. And maybe the punchline of it was kind of like, make sure they're American Express traveler's checks.
I'm pretty sure you're right. I read something about that that line was a reference to a commercial. I didn't know that commercial. I have no memory of it. You have a vague memory of it. So there you go. When Jack and Joan are really talking to each other, they're inside this fuselage, and he picks up a newspaper or a Playboy or a Rolling Stone or something? And he sees, oh no, the Doobie Brothers broke up. I thought that was kind of funny. And, you know, from a test of time perspective, that was true in 1984 because they broke up in 82 and then they got back together and they're still touring today. They put out an album a couple of years ago. I don't think anyone really cares that much about the Doobie Brothers, but that kind of made me chuckle.
Yeah, the thing is, for me, I didn't get that reference because I don't know that the Doobie Brothers broke up. I mean, that's not something I know. So I got it. I figured it out. But I also I didn't realize how old that was or how long has this guy been in Colombia.
That's fair. That's fair. They also really extend the joke about what was the illegal contraband on the plane. Colton says, this would get you 5 years back home, but it could get you life in prison here. Well, what is it? Oh, it's marijuana. Yes. Have you smoked it? Why, yes, I went to college. It's like a very long back and forth about pot.
Yeah, I mean, they really had to justify why these two people who are good people know what marijuana looks and smells like. Because, oh, she's a romance novelist, so she doesn't have the devil's lettuce. But, you know, back in college, she did a little bit.
I mean, I will show my ignorance here. Is Colombia known for marijuana? I feel like I associate it with cocaine.
I was thinking the same thing. I would think it'd be, you know, the coca leaves. Because get it from Mexico or something, right? I mean, I'm basing this off Narcos. I mean, in the 80s, like, wasn't it coming from Mexico? I don't know.
I don't really know. And so whatever. If people are laughing at me and they know more about drugs, then fine. But speaking of drugs, I do really like the scene with Juan, the drug dealer. They get to like this little town. They're asking for a car. And the joke is that they encounter the leader of this village who's a dangerous drug smuggler. But he loves Joan. He's a big fan of her novels. And so he's really excited to meet her and he's going to help him. And he gives them a ride and, you know, helps them evade Zolo's bad guys and everything. I thought that was really funny.
Oh, I love that scene. Did you recognize that actor?
I didn't. I looked up his IMDb because I was like, who is this guy? He's delightful. He's in Three Amigos.
Yes, he is El Guapo. And right. He's just as charming in Three Amigos. And
your sister Joanna called dibs on Three Amigos, I believe.
Yes, I'm going to try to do it with both my sister and my older brother, Andy. We'll try to get that one, too.
Ooh, okay.
That should be fun.
And I mean, the joke could have gotten old pretty quickly, but it doesn't because they kind of change the joke where it's not just that he's a big fan of hers and he's not going to kill her. While they are escaping and, you know, bad guys are firing machine guns at him, they presumably don't know that they're in a movie where no one can shoot and they're fine. But the drug dealer is like, oh, that's where I grew up. That's the tree that me and my brother used to play on. Like, he's giving them a tour. There's something about it that I just found really, really fun and funny and charming and sweet. And I loved all of it up until the part where they just so happen, by random coincidence, to drive by the Devil's Fork, which is a very important symbol on the treasure map that they're holding. It was like, well, Colombia is a pretty big country, and they just so happen to randomly drive by this one tree purely by chance. That sort of made the whole treasure hunt aspect of the movie feel less important. And maybe that's by design, because, you know, this isn't really like an Indiana Jones kind of movie where it's all about one clue leading to the next clue, to the next thing, to the next thing. But it was just kind of like, oh, so they just kind of drove past it. And then, like, they find the treasure instantly once they go back to that tree.
Right. I mean, it's kind of the same trope as same thing that happens in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the Goonies, where they have this map, but they just don't know what the starting point is.
Right.
I think it's more lazy. There's a part where Danny DeVito's character, and we haven't really talked about him yet, but his character's like, I can't find these guys, boss. Like, there's nowhere to be found. And then suddenly turns around and he's like, they're right behind me.
Right. Never mind. There they are.
Yeah, you know, and at least that, okay, you know, he's in the town. Yeah. You know, that's at least reasonable that they might run into each other there.
Right. And speaking of Ralph, the Danny DeVito character, when we were talking about Splash, we were kind of talking about like this 80s trope of someone who just keeps getting hurt because it's funny, I guess. And it happens in this movie where Ralph is tailing them and then he's like gonna grab the map from her purse, but he grabs the wrong lady's purse and then he gets beaten up. Ha ha ha. That happens a few times in this movie, and I was like, okay, well, we're kind of proving the point that was an 80s trope.
Yeah, it's an 80s thing, and I do think it can be very funny. Wile E. Coyote, I mean, that's the whole point of Wile E. Coyote cartoon. He just gets beaten up over and over and over. It's progressively funnier sometimes.
I never found Wile E. Coyote funny.
The thing I found frustrating about him is, why didn't he just try it again?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it was a little too sci-fi. Like, he paints the tunnel on the cave wall, and the Roadrunner can run right through it, but he can't.
Right.
Or he saws a hole in the bridge, and the whole bridge falls down except for the circle that the Roadrunner is standing on. Those ones were cheating. And Joanna and I, my sister, when we used to watch a Wile E. Coyote episode, we would count how many losses Wile E. Coyote had and how many we counted the Roadrunner had. Because if the Roadrunner sort of died, we're like, no, that's bullshit. That's a win. It's 7-1.
Fair. But also around this time in the movie, there's this other thing that goes on, which is also kind of Han Solo-esque also, where Colton is actively planning to ditch Joan. He's going to get a copy of that map. That map is important to him, and so he's going to find a Xerox machine, and he's going to Xerox a copy of that map. He says the word Xerox way too many times, but whatever, it's 1984. And then Joan decides, hey, let's go and find the treasure together. He had stolen the map, but he like very subtly puts it back into her purse. And then when Ralph meets up with them after they find the emerald, like a couple of scenes later, he says like that was his plan all along. He was just going to find the emerald and ditch you. And then Joan says, no, no, what are you talking about? That was my idea. And Ralph says, no, that's what any good con man will do. He'll make you think that it was your idea. And he was right. Ralph is right about Colton. How he knows all of this is quite beyond me, because he was getting beaten up by the other lady at the restaurant So he would have no visibility into any of that.
Unless he's just guessing correctly, because he knows what this diamond is, or what this emerald is. It's worth enough to, like, live a life of luxury, as we find from the end of the film.
Sure, but he doesn't know anything about Colton to presume that.
Because he's saying Colton is probably a scumbag like himself. I guess you could call it projection.
Okay.
Since Ralph would do it, he figures anyone else would do it in this situation.
And he is right, because that is what Colton was doing. But then Joan is furious about that, and then that story is dropped. Nothing comes from that. There is no other fight. There's no other conversation. There's no apology. There's no coming around from that where Colton says, hey, you know what? I was going to ditch you, but then we spent that time together and I really fell for you and I decided I didn't want to, or whatever. Like, there is absolutely no resolution. And I kept waiting for it. I kept waiting for that moment to come, and it never does.
Exactly. I was wondering if I missed something, because did Ralph watch him photocopy it? Was he peeking in through the window? Because that would have been, that's all you needed to see.
Right.
He just needed proof that he saw it. But, you know, again, he could have guessed correctly. But I thought once she figures out, oh, here's the Han Solo moment.
Yeah.
He gets his reward. He's going to walk away. And nope, he's coming back. He's going to save the day, even though his life, he didn't have to do it. He's going to do it just for the honor. And he does, you know, honorably save her kind of at the end, gives up the alligator to help her. You're right. There isn't a payoff where she kind of metaphorically slaps him in the face, or slaps him in the face because she's so mad at him. You're right. There is nothing that he redeems himself or apologizes for.
Right. And I mean, in Star Wars, Han Solo kind of just does come back, but you see him kind of struggle with it a little bit. So it is different. Also, you said alligator. It's not an alligator. It's a crocodile. Do you know how you can tell the difference?
There are differences, but I don't know the differences.
There are a lot of very complicated ones. There's one really simple one. One of them you'll see in a while. The other one will see you later.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's how you can tell. When Colton comes back at the end, he kind of doesn't have to. He's doing it for her because he has the emerald. He could have just gone on his merry little way. He does the right thing, but yeah, there's just no resolution to that story, which is pretty frustrating, I thought.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk about the part that I would call the Indiana Jones part, where they're in the jungle, they're finding the treasure. I think you said it correctly. It's way too quick, and there's actually no danger. I'm actually surprised they didn't do any more Indiana Jones ripoffs with, like, traps and all kinds of stuff there. It was more like, it was just a little doll sitting there, and she goes, wait, in one of my novels, they hid the jewel in the doll. So then he breaks it open, and there's the jewel.
Right.
And then Ralph is there to steal it. It was all so quick. I was kind of thinking, again, from the poster, that was going to be the climax of this film. No, there's still 25 minutes left.
What did you think that the emerald looked like?
I don't know. It didn't really remind me of anything. I mean, it looked like a huge, like, Hope Diamond kind of, like, but just green.
Oh, yeah. I just thought it was kryptonite. Like, oh, he found kryptonite.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was just one of those, you know, huge pieces of green glass.
Yeah. So then Joan and Colton get separated. Joan has the map. Colton has the emerald. Joan brings the map to Ira, who's Ralph's cousin. Also, by the way, all of this starts because Joan's sister's husband found this map, and he mails the map to Joan, and then the bad guys kidnap his wife and kill him, and that's how Joan is involved. Like, how did this guy get the map? Like, I mean, I realize, like, maybe no one cares, but I thought there could maybe be a little bit more explanation of how this random family got so caught up in it. Also, by the way, did you recognize the sister, Joan's sister, in this movie?
No, who is that?
That is Mary Ellen Trainer. We were talking about her when we talked about Die Hard, because I said that she looked familiar, and she's the journalist in Die Hard, not the scummy William Atherton guy, his news partner or whatever. She's also the mom in Goonies, and she was also Robert Zemeckis's wife.
Hmm, interesting.
Yes. The kidnappers are totally willing to trade the sister for the map, but then Zolo comes up because Zolo doesn't care about the map. He just wants a diamond, and he has Colton. And then he's like, okay, Colton, I have you now. Tell me, where is the emerald? He had it on him the whole time. But it's like, why did he need to bring Colton from the hotel where he picked him up to this secret rendezvous and then ask him, where's the emerald? He could have just, you know, beaten the shit out of him, found out where the emerald was, and then left. Like, what does he care about the map? He doesn't need the map to the treasure once he has the treasure.
Yeah, exactly. The diamond or the emerald is revealed. Colton kicks it and says, yeah, screw you all. He kicks it into the crocodile pit. Mm-hmm. But right before it's about to fall into the pit, Zolo catches it. And he's like, ha ha, thank you for the jewel. And then a croc comes out, bites his hand off. Pretty gruesome, I have to say.
Yeah.
It was more gruesome than I thought it was going to be. They showed like the muscle. And like it was pretty for a split second. But I thought it was kind of funny. Colton goes after the crocodile and is like, fuck you, I'm getting this thing out of it. And he's wrestling a croc, and Joan is she's fighting Zolo, so he has the big choice. Yeah, very Indiana Jones The Last Crusade-esque, but that would be, you know, 4 years later, 1989, when Indiana Jones has to choose between the cup and his father, or the girl and the cup. But this time he chooses, oh, the hell with it, and he lets the croc go. He picks up the gun. There is no bullets in it, but ultimately it's thought that counts there. And Joan is able to save the day a little bit. She's sets the guy on fire, and then he falls into the croc pit, which was so obvious from the beginning of the film because, you know, in these James Bond kind of films, when you happen to see a shark tank in the villain's lair, you know there's gonna be a shark tank scene later, but they pointed out, notice the crocs, everyone?
Yeah.
Do you notice the crocs? And I'm like, okay, well, this is going to be either how they show someone die gruesomely to prove how bad the guy is, or the bad guy dies in this at the end.
Yes to all of that, but it's Ira, Ralph's cousin, who's, you know, like the head kidnapper, who has the pet crocodiles. So I thought that's how he was going to die. I thought that Joan was going to dispatch Zolo like the heroine does in that first scene, which is really in the romance novel. And she does. She kind of like throws the dagger in a very similar way, but he blocks it. So I thought that was clever. It was a callback. It was full circle. But haha, it doesn't work in real life. It only works in the novel. And then she is going to die. Colton does not save her. I had to watch that scene 3 times to figure out how she gets away from Zolo. He's got a cigar, and she grabs the cigar and then, like, rips it out of his mouth and puts it on his face. And then he, like, is, oh no! And then she's able to get the upper hand. I didn't see that. Like, I literally had to watch that thing 3 times before I saw that's how she gets away from him. But yeah, I did like the fact that she saves herself, and it's not Colton who saves the day.
Right. I mean, he gets the credit for, you know, giving up the treasure in the Han Solo-esque way. He's going back into the danger. But then he does something very stupid. He dives head first after the crocodile. That's basically the end of the movie. And we have an epilogue. It's sometime later. We're back in the big city, which I do like because we've been in the jungles. It's a very stark difference from where she's been. You see Colton again. I kind of like it. I mean, he comes out with alligator boots, which shows you he got the croc. I guess crocodile boots.
Mm-hmm.
He got the croc. He killed it. And I guess that means he sold the diamond, the emerald for millions. I mean,
yeah,
I guess so.
Yeah, because he has the boat that he was talking about.
I guess so. That's where he got it from. Maybe I missed it, but what is the origin of this diamond again?
The emerald?
Yeah. The emerald.
It's a treasure.
Right, but like, did they say like...
No,
they didn't really say where it's from. Okay, because I couldn't really tell because, you know, you'd think, is this an artifact? Is this like some smugglers like hid it there 50 years ago and they're trying to find it? Like, did he basically sell some indigenous emerald? Or, you know, even legitimately, does he get a finder's fee? I was just wondering.
No, it's a valid question. I mean, the fact that it was hidden in a doll in the cave makes me think that it's not super ancient, or at least that it wasn't hidden that long ago, but I don't know. And the movie doesn't bother to explain. Getting back to the scene in the city, when, you know, he's got the boat like parked in front of her apartment, all I could imagine was a New York cop just going over like, what are you doing? You can't park a boat here. I was expecting that, and that didn't happen.
She also didn't know that he's alive at this point.
Right, she doesn't know. But in the scene before with her publisher, played by Holland Taylor, famous actress, was on Two and a Half Men, she says, "Oh, you're such a hopeless romantic." And then Joan says, "No, I was a hopeless romantic. Now I'm a hopeful romantic," which was really kind of hitting the nail on the head, but whatever. And so she does have faith. She does have optimism. So I think she is expecting Colton to come back, which he does, and they have their happy ending. It's cheesy, but fine, whatever. But let me ask you, James, what do you think about Romancing the Stone? Do you think this movie stands the test of time?
I have to say, I understand why this was popular. Kathleen Turner, I didn't really know her very well. I know she's famous. I actually know her more as a voice actress. What's the first thing you're thinking I'm thinking of?
Yeah, I was even going to do a bit with you of this isn't the first movie we've done on the podcast with Kathleen Turner, but it's the first movie where you see her.
Right.
Because you hear her in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. She's Jessica Rabbit.
Exactly. And she did two very famous Fox television cartoons. Do you know what two roles she did? You have to know one of them.
The Simpsons.
Right. She plays Homer's mother.
No.
No, that's not Homer's mother. She plays... No, I'm sorry. She was the Lisa Lionheart.
Yeah, the Malibu Stacy.
Yeah, the Malibu Stacy inspiration. But in King of the Hill, she plays Mrs. Strickland.
Okay.
And she is fantastic in that. I didn't really know her that well as an actress, and I thought she's very charming in this film. I really liked her. I liked the first act of this film, Kathleen Turner's character. There's one thing and one thing alone that I remembered from this film as a child. That is when Colton takes a machete and chops off the heels on her high heels. She's like, "Oh, those are Italian." And he goes, "Now they're practical."
Right.
And he's absolutely correct. And there was a movie a few years ago that got a lot of flack for this Jurassic World. Bryce Dallas Howard's character.
Mm-hmm.
She does the entire thing in high heels.
Right.
And she's running from a T-Rex in high heels. And essentially, from what I understand, you're basically standing on your tippy toes when you're on high heels. That's essentially what you're doing. I remember weirdly when I watched Jurassic World and thinking of the same thing. She's on high heels. Why don't they just chop them off or rip them off? And weirdly, I think it was Romancing the Stone that I was thinking of.
Okay.
That I had seen that. And that was a very smart thing to do. But, you know, like I said in the beginning of this podcast, there were a lot of Indiana Jones, quote unquote, ripoffs. And I would honestly say that if you want to see this kind of movie, first of all, watch Indiana Jones. Any of those are, you know, better than this film. But I would say a bunch of these ripoff or inspired by films are better than this one. I would say The Mummy is better than this. I haven't seen National Treasure in a while, but, you know, I remember it being a little more fun than this. The film just, it isn't the Indiana Jones film that I thought it was. It's just, I'm not that inspired by Colton. I like Michael Douglas. I don't really like Colton.
Yeah.
You know, because I guess you like Han Solo because he's scummy, but, you know, he totally redeems himself and there's a big charm to him. Why doesn't he, like, he knows something about exotic birds and parrots and that's how he's able to, like, help later. And, oh, okay, you know, there's bird smuggler, but that saves the day.
Right.
There's nothing really that redeems him. And in the end, what does he get? He does get the woman, but more he gets the money. That's really what he gets in the end. And I don't think this is a bad movie. I think it's perfectly watchable. And actually, you could see where Robert Zemeckis is honing his craft here. I just don't think the film stands the test of time. If it was made today, it would have a very different score. There's a lot of times that it kind of has this like, bum, 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 bum. It has this weird comedic score. It should have something a little bit better. Not, it doesn't have to be John Williams, Hans Zimmer.
This is Alan Silvestri who does the score.
Fine, it's Alan Silvestri who winds up doing Back to the Future. There were parts of it that were just too comedic for me. When I read some stuff about this film, someone had said that there was a film with Channing Tatum and Sandra Bullock a few years ago called The Lost City. And apparently they said, oh, it was very Romancing the Stone-like. It was the first film that really captured that Romancing the Stone stuff since an Indiana Jones film. You know, I'd argue The Mummy did that. Maybe National Treasure. There's better versions of this film. So it's not a must-see film. And this one just doesn't make it. And for me, Romancing the Stone doesn't stand the test of time. What about you, Al? Romancing the Stone, it was a big hit back then, but does it still hold up today?
I don't think so. I really agree with virtually everything you said. It starts really, really strong. And I was into this idea right out of the gate of here's a romance novelist, but she's lonely and she's going to go on an adventure and she's going to find the meaning in her life. And that's corny. That's cheesy. But I really like Kathleen Turner and I really like Michael Douglas and I like Danny DeVito. And they are very, very charming in this movie. They don't have the greatest chemistry. They have some chemistry. And I know that the three of them were in another movie together called War of the Roses, which I've never seen. And I would like to see that at some point.
It was a huge novel that wound up being, I believe, a flop film.
Okay. But there's just a lot in this movie that I think is missing. And I was reading today about that screening you mentioned earlier where the studio was so convinced it was going to be a flop and then they pulled Zemeckis off of Cocoon because they knew it was going to be a flop. And Zemeckis didn't just say, screw you guys, this movie's going to be a hit, and then released it as it is. Zemeckis made a lot of changes after that screening. Apparently, he cut a lot of footage from Acts 2 and 3. They completely reshot that scene in the plane where Joan and Colton are talking. He did work to this movie to fix it. I don't know exactly what he did, and I don't know all of the changes that he made, but my guess is that he deleted a lot of the stuff that we're talking about. Maybe there was a scene where Colton's knowledge of birds came in handy. There had to have been a scene where Colton apologizes and learns his lesson and has some kind of arc or turn. Because you know what? If you want to be really brutally honest about it, Colton doesn't need an arc. If you want to position this movie as a gender-flipped Indiana Jones, James Bond kind of movie, you can do that. Then Colton is just arm candy and he doesn't have a story. He's just there to look handsome and dashing and great, that's fine. But they put all the pieces of, you know, he's a con man and he's tricking her and he wants to Xerox the map and then he's going to ditch her. And then they do nothing with it and that doesn't work. If you're going to set these things up, you need to pay them off. And the movie just, it doesn't work. It has great ideas. It has really fun moments, but no, it doesn't work. Also, this isn't like a huge criticism of the movie, but I did think the two sets of bad guys was a little confusing because you have Ralph and Ira, and Ira's like the head bad guy, Ralph's cousin, but who the fuck is that guy? We don't know him. He's not intimidating. He's just like some bald douchebag. And then there's Zolo, and is Zolo working alone? Because he comes to New York looking for the map, but then he also has this huge army in Colombia. It's just like very poorly fleshed out. So I would agree with you that it does not stand the test of time. And next week, we're going to watch the sequel, the one that killed the franchise. I am not optimistic, James.
Let's give it a shot. Open mind.
All right, fine. Let's do it. Next week, we will watch The Jewel of the Nile. We invite you to come back and hear our thoughts on that movie. Until then, we want to hear your thoughts on all things. You can write to us at Test of Time Pod on Facebook, X, Instagram, and Threads. You can also email us, thetestoftimepodcast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next time, everybody.
Bye.